Disc 10.
For a moment I wondered if she was making a ghastly joke, or if that pea brain had given way at last. But no, I knew her artless prattle too well, and that she meant every damned word, and there was no point in bellowing disbelief. I forced myself to be calm and sit mum, while I downed my brandy and poured another stiffen before demanding, no doubt in an incredulous croak, "You're telling me that he didn't cheat, but you did? And that you were laying a plant on him?" Seeing how bewildered I translated. "Making him look guilty, damn it, for the love of God, woman? Why?" Her eyes widened.
"Why, to punish him, to pay him out for his bad conduct, his black wickedness."
All of a sudden she was breathing fiery indignation, Boadicea, in a lace dressing gown.
"And so I did, and now he is disgraced, and a pariah, and a hissing, and serve him right. He should be torn by wild horses, so he should. He is a base, horrid man, and I hope he suffers as he deserves."
She began to butter toast ferociously while I sat stricken, wondering what the devil he'd done. Horrid suspicions leaping to mind. But before I could voice them, she gave one of her wordless Caledonian exclamations of impatience, left off buttering, tossed her head and regained her composure.
"Oh, fee! Harry, I beg your pardon, getting het up in that unseemly way. Oh, but when I think of him..."
She took a deep breath and spooned marmalade onto her plate.
"But it's by with now, thank goodness, and he's paid for a villain. Dale mend him, and I'm the happy woman that's done it, for I never thought to have the chance. And long I bided, waiting the day."
As always, when deeply moved, she was getting scotcher by the minute. But now she paused for a mouthful of toast.
"And then at Tranby, when I heard that Wilson loon whispering to his friend, and understood what was what, I soon saw in a blink how I might settle his hash for him once for all. And I did that,"
says she, taking a grim nibble.
"Oh, if only I could make marmalade like Granny Morrison's. There's no right flavour to this bot stuff. Would you oblige me with the honey, dearest?"
I shoved it across in a daze. The enormity, the impossibility of what she said she'd done, her fury against Cumming for heaven knew what unimaginable reason. I still couldn't take it in, but I knew that if you were to get sense out of Elspeth, you must let her babble to a finish in her own weird way, give in what assistance you may. I clutched at the nearest straw. "What did Wilson whisper to whom? When?"
"Why, on the first night, when the prince said, 'Who's for baccarat, everyone?' And they went to play in the smoking room, and Count Lutzoff and I and Miss Naylor and Lady Brougham went to watch."
She frowned at the honey.
"Is it very fattening, do you suppose? Oh, well, so the prince said, 'Shall you and I make a jolly bank together, Lady Flashman?' But I said I did not know the rules and must watch till I got the hang of it. And then I should be honoured to help him, and he said, quite jocose, 'Ah, well, one of these days, then.' And Count Lutzoff found me a chair next to that young fellow with the poker up his back, like all the guardies. What's his name?"
"Barclay Levitt, you mean? Elspeth, for mercy's sake!"
"Like enough he might have been Barclay Square for all the sense I could get from him. So then they played, and after a wee while, the Wilson boy, the one they call Jack, though his name is Arthur, I think, or is it Stanley? Anyway, I heard him whisper to Levitt, 'I said, this is a bit hot,' which I thought odd, when it wasn't at all. I was quite chilly away from the fire and without my shawl. But a moment later I saw he meant something quite otherwise, for he whispered again that the man next to him was cheating, and I saw he meant Billy Cumming. Harry, dear, would you ring for hot water? The potter's got quite cold. I'm sure they don't make Delft as they used to, or perhaps the cosy is getting thin. They stuff them with anything at all these days. We always had a good thick woollen one at home that Grizel knitted, but they do tend to smell rather after a while."
"Husbands tend to lose their reason rather after a while, too, so lest you should suffer likewise, I'll relieve her account with a precis. She had heard Levitt say Wilson must be mistaken, and Wilson had told him to look for himself. Lady Flashman, scenting mischief breast high, had also fixed her bonny blue gimlets on the suspect. Seen him drop red counters on his paper after coups had been called, and heard Levitt mutter, 'By Jove, it is too hot.' But unlike the two young men, she had concluded that Cumming was playing fair. Simple she may be, but she has her country's instinct for anything to do with money and sharp practice. and her unerring eye had spotted what they'd missed.
But I was positive, Harry, that he did not drop his counters until after the prince had paid the wagers, and what he was doing was laying his wager for the next coup.
Well, says she earnestly, that was not cheating, was it? But they thought it was, you see. They did not understand that he was playing that French system of his, the coup de thingamabob, which was mentioned in court last week. I did not understand it myself till I read about it in the papers, and realized he was telling the truth when he said he did not cheat. But at the time, of course, I did not know about the French coup thing, and while I did not think he was cheating, how could I be sure when they thought he was? And I suppose they knew more about the game than I did. In any event, she concluded cheerfully, it did not signify whether he had cheated or not, so long as they thought he did, you see, my love.
Heaven forfend that I should ever fail to grasp something that was clear to her. But as I gazed into those forget-me-not eyes fixed so eagerly on mine, I had to confess myself somewhat buffaloed, and begged her to continue, which she did at length. And gradually, light began to dawn. Later that night, after the game, Count Lutzov, the cabbage-eating punt fancier, whom she fleeced at backgammon 2 nights later, had come to her, like rumour painted full of tongues, with news that a scandalous crisis was at hand. Sir William Gordon Cumming had been seen cheating, and watch was to be kept on in the following night. How Lutzov had heard this, God alone knows, for according to what was said in court, young Wilson had confided his suspicions to no one on the Monday night except Levitt, and later his mother. But there you are. Lutzov had got wind of it somehow. Sly bastards, these squareheads. Of course, he swore dear Lady Flashman to silence. I could hold in no longer. But damn it all, girl, why didn't you say something then? You believed he hadn't cheated, and that Wilson and Levitt were mistaken, and yet you let him lay a trap for him on the following night. But that's what it was.
I should think I did, cries she. It was then I saw my chance to be revenged on him, whether he cheated or no the first night. I could make sure he was seen to cheat on the Tuesday, when every eye would be on him. It was ever so easy,
she went on serenely.
I begged Lady Coventry to give me her place beside him, and forgive me, dearest, and do not be too shocked. I put my knee against his, and smiled couthiously to fetch him, for he always had a fancy to me, you know, and men are so vain and silly. Even an old dame like me can gawk them. Well, it was no work at all to have him put his hand on mine to guide me in making my bets, and I saw to it that he kept it there, and made a flirt of it, our hands together whenever we wagered, and that is how counters came to be on his paper, when they should not have been.
This was too much. Of all the nonsense, don't tell me you can palm a gaming chip, as if you were Klondike Kate. Why, it would take a top sharp, a first-rate mechanic.
Harry,
says she quietly, and held out her hand, the empty palm towards me.
Take my hand, love. Yours on the back of mine, so. And now we lay them down, and then we take them away.
So help me God, there was the little round lid of the mustard pot on the cloth which had been bare. I gaped, struggling for speech. My God, where on earth did you learn that?
Oh, ever so long ago from that friend of yours in the 11th Hussars. What was his name? Brand? O'Brien? It's the simplest sleight of hand, really.
Bryant? That damned toad.
Please, Harry, do not thunder. He was the cleverest conjurer, you remember.
He was a low, conniving blackguard. Do you know he once laid a plant on me? Made me out a cheat and swindler in front of Bentinck and Disraeli and half the bloody country? A dreadful suspicion struck me. Had the loathsome Bryant been another of her fancy men? When the blue blazes did you know him?
How can I remember? 'Twas years and years since, about the Crimea time, I think, when we were acquainted with Lord Cardigan, and O'Brien, or Brand, was one of his officers, and showed me ever so many diverting tricks. Surely you mind how I used to amuse Harvey and wee Selina with them? No, well, you must have been from home. At all events,
says she reasonably,
if O'Brien once embarrassed you with his jiggery-pokery, would that be the time Papa sent you away to Africa? My, he was a dour man when he wanted to be. Well, you can see it was not hard for me to do the like by Billy Cumming, was it?
There is a tide in the affairs of men when you simply have to chuck it. As, for example, when you learn that the wife of your unsuspecting bosom is a practised thimble-rigger who has used her flash arts to ruin an innocent man. for it must all be true. She could never have invented anything so wild. And it fitted the facts and solved the mystery. And while no normal being would even have thought of such a thing, or had the audacity to attempt it, Elspeth has always been that alarming mixture of an idiot and a bear cat for nerve. Being a poltroon myself, I blurted out the first thing that came into my head. But dear God, suppose you'd been caught.
Fiddlesticks, have I not just shown you? And who, she looked droll, would ever suspect dear old Lady Flashman? Once, perhaps, I was a wee bit gallus when he was playing with his pencil, and I took his hand as though to write something between us, and pushed a counter over the line. And the silly comrades all swore in court that he had done it. Why, I was as safe as coots.
Do you know, looking at that angelic smile and contemplating what she'd done, I was almost scared of her for the first time in 50 years. My Elspeth, whose kindly, feckless good nature I'd taken for granted, had confessed with shameless satisfaction to a crime that would have shocked Delilah. If she'd burned coming at the stake, she couldn't have done worse by him. And suddenly I found myself thinking of Sancerre and Nariman and the Dragon Empress and the Amazons and Rana Valona. I've known some fragile little blossoms in my time. And their genius for finding a man's tenderest spot and twisting till he squeals. And realizing that my gentle helpmeet was their sister under her cream and roses skin. Well, ex Elspetho semper aliquid novi. From Elspeth, always something new, thinks I. Who'd have believed it? And thank God she's on my side. But what in the name of all that was wonderful could Cummy have done to drive her to such a monstrous revenge?
I don't care to say,
was her astonishing reply when I demanded to be told. Not for the first time, you'll note. Her smile had vanished.
It was too outre for words.
Her vocabulary being what it is, that might mean anything from farting to high treason. I felt an icy clutch at my innards, rage against Cummin for whatever atrocious offence he might have given her, and a fear that I might be expected to do something dangerous about it, like offering to shoot the swine. But I couldn't leave it there. Having told her appalling tale with happy abandon, she was now plainly uneasy at my question, frowning and looking askance.
"Please, do not ask me,"
says she. I knew roaring and pounding the table wouldn't serve, so I waited, pushed back my chair and patted my knee. "Here, old lady," says I. And after a moment she came round and seated herself on my creaking thigh. "Now then, you're bound to tell me, you know, and I shan't be a bit angry either. Honest Injun. You can kick 20 Cummings into the gutter and I'll lose no sleep, because I know my girl wouldn't do such a thing without good cause. But I must know why you paid him out, and why you didn't tell me all about it that night at Tranby." I gave her a squeeze and a kiss, and my quizziest, flashy smile. "We've never had any secrets from each other, have we? I'll fry in hell, no doubt about it."
"I couldn't tell you then,"
says she, nestling against my shoulder.
"I feared you would be angry and might tell people. No, no, you would not do that, but you might have done something, I don't know what, to interfere and spoil it, and prevent him meeting his just deserts, the dirty beast."
"Only Elspeth can talk like that with a straight face. Comes of Paisley and reading novels." Her mouth was drooping, and there were absolute tears in her eyes.
"You see, I knew what I'd done was dreadful and dishonourable, and you are the very soul of honour."
She said it, God help me.
"The chevalier sans peur et sans reproche. That's what the Queen called you, I heard her."
"Bless me, did she?
And if I'd told you at Tranby, why, you would have been in such a fix, on the horns of Tantalus, whether to speak out, which I knew you wouldn't ever do for my sake, or else be an accomplice in my dishonourable deed, and that would not have done."
She dabbed her eyes with her sleeve.
"So I had to be silent and deceive you, and I'm so sorry for that, dearest, I truly am. But not for what I did to Billy Cumming, and if you blame me, I can't help it. Oh, Harry, I have so wanted to confess it all to you so many, many times. but I was bound to wait until the trial was over, you see, for then it would be too late.
She had her arms round my neck, eyes piteous in entreaty.
Oh, Harry, my Joe, can you forgive me? If you don't, I think I'll die. For I only did it for love of you and your honour.
You understand now why I said that Elspeth must be allowed to babble to a conclusion if you're to reach sense at last. Well, we were getting on. Dear lass, says I, trying not to wince with my leg cracking under the strain, whatever does my honour have to do with it? And for heaven's sake, what did Gordon Cumming do to make you hate him so and serve him such a ghastly turn? At last it came in a whisper, her head bowed.
He called you a coward.
I damn near let her fall on the floor. What was that?
A coward.
Her head came up, and suddenly she was fairly blazing with rage.
He said it to my face, he did. Oh, I burn with shame to think of it. The vile falsehood, the evil, wicked storyteller. He said you'd run away from the Sikhs or the Zulus or someone at that place in Africa. Isel something or other.
Isel Luana? God love us, who didn't? But she was too angry to hear me raging on in full spate about how the brazen rascal had dared to say that I'd fled headlong and escaped in a cart while my comrades perished and had skulked in the hospital at Rorke's Drift. All true except the bit about the hospital. Fat chance anyone had to skulk with the roof on fire and those fearsome black buggers coming through the wall. And she'd been so distraught by his slanders that she'd removed from his presence, nigh weeping, and if she'd been a man she would have slain him on the spot.
To hear him lying in his jealous teeth, the toad, defaming you, the bravest, gallantest, best soldier in all the world, as everyone knows, that have won the V.C. and done ever so many heroic deeds, the Hector of Afghanistan and the Bayar of Balaclava, it said in the papers. And I cut them out, everyone, and keep them, and didn't I see you fight like a lion against those disagreeable folk in Madagascar, and you brought me away safe and sound, and had followed to the ends of the earth, all for my sake, and rescued me that didn't deserve it. And you the dearest, kindest, valiant knight, so you are.
At which point she buried her face in my neck and howled for a spell, while I moved her fine poundage onto a convenient chair and massaged my numbed limb, marvelling at the mysterious workings of the female mind. She continued to cling to me, uttering muffled anathemas against Cumming, and at last came to the surface moist and pink.
I would not have told you if you had not pressed me,
gulped she,
for it soils my lips to have to repeat his sinful lies. He tried to dishonour you, and I was resolved to dishonour him by hook or crook, if it took a lifetime, and if what I did was dishonourable too, and underhand and sly. I don't care a docken, he's a cur, and that's what he is, and now every dog on the midden kens what he is.
It ain't easy for a sonsy matron with blonde curls to look like the wrath of God, but she was managing uncommon well. She sniffed, defiant and soulful together.
Now you know the kind of woman you married, and if you spurn me it will break my heart, but I would do it again 1,000 times.
I swear she gritted her teeth.
No one speaks ill of my hero, and that's the size of it.
And that, dear reader, is why William Gordon Cumming was cast into outer darkness, because he'd blown on Flash's honour. Ironic, wouldn't you say? It had been his bad luck that where an ordinary wife would have treated his insults with icy disdain, or at most urged her husband to call on the cad with a horsewhip, my eccentric lady had nursed her vengeance for years, before ruining him with a stratagem so dangerous, never mind its warped lunacy, that my blood still runs cold to think of it 20 years on. Social ruin aside, the crazy bitch could have gone to jail for criminal conspiracy. Not that that would enter her empty head, or deter her if it had. The only qualm she'd felt was that if I learned the truth of the disgraceful way she'd engineered Cumming's downfall, I might recoil from her in virtuous disgust, which only goes to show that after 50 years she knew no more of my true character than I apparently did of hers. And she'd done it all for a mere word. Coward. A true word, if only she'd known it. Aye, and for the love of Harry. Well, I ain't the most sentimental chap, as you know, but as I thought about that, and considered her while she dried her tears, well, damn it, I was touched. Not many husbands had given such proof of loyalty and fidelity and devotion carried to the point of insanity. Not that I'm saying she's mad, mind, but, well, you're bound to agree there's something loose up yonder. Still, balmy or not, the little darling deserved every comfort I could give her, and I was about to embrace her with cries of reassurance, when a thought crossed my mind. She was watching me with pink-nosed anxiety.
"Oh, Harry, can you forgive me? Oh, why do you look so stern? Do you despise me?"
"Eh? Oh, Lord, no. What despise you? Good God, girl, I'm proud of you." And I hugged her, slightly preoccupied.
"Are you sure? Oh, my darling, when I see you frown, and know that what I did was ignoble and unladylike, and not at all the thing, and how could you be proud of me? Oh, I fear that you disdain me. Please, dear one, tell me it's not so."
She put her hands either side of my face, imploring a point blank, which ain't helpful when you're trying to think. I forced myself to sound sincere and hearty. "'Course I don't disdain you, you little goose. What for snookering Gordon coming so cleverly? I should say not. It was the smartest stunt since Torres Vedras, and—"
"Torres who?"
"And nothing ignoble about it, so don't fret your bonny head. He's well served." "Damn right. Nothing's too bad for the man who tells truth about flashy. But that was by the way—"
"Oh, Harry."
She was all over me, arms round my neck, fairly squeaking with joy.
"Then you're not angry, and I'm truly forgiven. Oh, you are the best, the kindest of husbands."
She kissed me for all she was worth.
"And all is truly well?"
"Absolutely, couldn't be better. So you mustn't cry any more. Make your pretty nose red if you do. Now, what about that tea you were going to ring for?" She kissed me again and fled from the room, calling for Jane, but in fact to make repairs to her appearance, as I'd known she would when I mentioned her nose. I wanted a moment to reflect. Cumming was down the drain. Excellent. Elspeth was none the worse for her idiotic behaviour. Indeed, she'd done me proud in her misguided way, championing my honour, as she conceived it. Excellent again. She'd solved the Tramby mystery, too, albeit her explanation was as staggering as it was undoubtedly true. On only one little point had she been reticent, and it was exercising me, rather. The whole world knew I was one of the few who'd escaped the Isan Luana massacre in 79, but that was no disgrace, since there were no living witnesses to my terrified flight. And if Cumming chose to make the worst out of it, much good it would do him with my heroic reputation. But that was by the way, since I gathered that he'd confided his opinion to Elspeth alone. The point was, when precisely had he done so, and in what circumstances? I didn't doubt he'd called me a coward, you understand, but it ain't the kind of thing a fellow says by way of social chat over the teacups, is it? Ah, Lady Flashman, delightful weather, is it not? And did you enjoy the gondoliers, such jolly tunes? No, I fear the dear bishop's health is not what it was. By the way, did I never tell you your husband's a bloody poltroon who ran screaming from Isan Luana? Oh, you hadn't heard? No, hardly. In my experience, which is considerable, observations like coward are usually made fortissimo at the climax of a first-rate turn-up between a lady and gentleman most intimately acquainted. A lover's quarrel, perhaps? You'll recall that Cumming was among those I'd suspected of dancing the honeymoon hornpipe with my dear one in days gone by. It had been no more than my normal suspicion of her, and had gone clean out of my head during the Tranby scandal. But now it was back with a vengeance. Yes, 'twould be about 10 years since she dropped Cumming's acquaintance abruptly, and my lurid imagination could conjure up the scene in some silken nest of sin around South Audley Street circa 1880. Cumming, all mustachioed and masterful in his long combinations, and my adulterous angel bursting proudly out of her corset as they slanged each other across the crumpled sheets of shame. God knows I've been there often enough myself, when passion has staled to moody discontent. Sullen exchanges wax into recrimination. The errant wife makes odious comparisons to the lover's disadvantage. And that's the moment when Lothario, cut to the quick, speaks his mind of the cuckolded husband. Your precious Harry's not so much of a man, I can tell you. Followed by a shriek of indignation and the crash of a hurled utensil. Aye, that's how it would have been, devil a doubt. Try as I might, I couldn't picture it any different. Cumming must have been the little trollop's lover, to call me a coward to her face. If this wasn't proof, nothing was. I sat brooding darkly, remembering the straw sticking to the back of her dress, after she'd been in the woods with that randy redskin spotted tail. Cardigan with his pants round his ankles, and her in bare buff, when I blundered boozily out of the cupboard where I'd been asleep. The shiny black boots that had betrayed her assignation with that smirking swine Watkins, or Watney, or whatever the hell his name was. Her preening herself in her sarong before that oily pirate Usman, who diddled me at cricket. And heaven knew how many others, of whom I'd feared the worst. Time and again I'd been torn by jealous, unproven suspicion, and resolved to have it out with her, and shirked at the last, because I'd rather not know. Well, not this time, begod. I felt my anger rising as I remembered her protestations that she'd only done the dirty on coming to avenge my honour. Ah! Like as not, her true reason for wreaking vengeance on him was because he'd kicked her out of bed. But if that were so, she'd never have said a word to me about laying a plant on him, would she? Oh, Lord, were my foul imaginings getting the better of me yet again? Was I judging her by my own murky lights? So many times I'd faced this same hideous question. Elspeth, true or false? It was high time I had an answer, and I was going red in the face and growling as she came tripping back into the room, plump and radiant, no sign at all of her recent distress.
Jane's bringing fresh tea and some of those little German biscuits, and, oh, you're not angry with me, dearest, and all is...
She stopped short in dismay.
Why, Harry, whatever's the matter? Why are you scowling so? Oh, my love, what is it?
I had risen in my jealous wrath. Now I sat down again, marshalling my words, while she viewed me in pretty alarm. Elspeth, says I, and stopped short in turn. What's that? Bringing tea, is she? Well, now, what about a pot of coffee for the old man, eh? Scowling? No, just this leg of mine giving me a twinge, the old wound, you know. Yeah, you come and sit on t'other one and give us a kiss. As the black chap said in Shakespeare's play, 'tis better as it is. Appendix. It hardly seemed worthwhile to give footnotes to Flashman's account of the Tramby-Croft affair, since almost all of them would have led the reader to the same authority, W. Tenmouth Shaw's The Baccarat Case, Gordon Cumming versus Wilson and others, 1932, in the notable British Trial series. It contains a full transcript of the trial, with notes and comments, and is the best and fullest work on the subject. Other books which touch on the case and related matters include Margaret Blunden, The Countess of Warwick, 1967, Piers Compton, Victorian Vortex, 1977, Philippe Julien, Edward and the Edwardians, and an anonymous work, The Private Life of the King, 1901. Tenmouth Shaw published his book to win justice for the memory of a man much wronged, and nailed his colours to the mast with his opening quotation from Truth, which asserted, after the trial, that a dog would not have been hanged on the evidence that convicted Gordon Cumming. It was an opinion shared by many, and if Flashman is to be believed, they were right. His view of the verdict aside, Mr. Shaw makes several points of interest. He describes the outcry against the Prince of Wales as outrageous, and one has to agree that whatever the faults of the future King Edward VII, he hardly deserved the storm which burst over his hapless head, from a press which knew a ripe scandal when it saw one, and was only too glad of a royal scapegoat. Mr. Shaw wondered if any newspaper of high standing in 1932 would have been so censorious. Perhaps not. He did not live to see the 1990s. At the same time, the prince showed lamentable judgment when the cheating allegation was first brought to his notice. And Mr. Shaw is plainly right when he suggests that the sensible thing would have been to insist on accused and accusers thrashing the matter out on the spot.
There was indeed a remarkable lack of common sense in the way the affair was handled, and in the pathetic belief that it could be kept quiet. Obviously, as Flashman confirms, panic struck not only the prince and his advisers, but Gordon Cumming also, or he would never have signed the damning document. Mr. Shaw is scathing on the conduct of the trial. The court being turned by consent of the judge into a theatre, and a shoddy theatre at that. Whether Flashman's sensational disclosure finally settles the controversy is for his readers to decide. It fits the known facts, and if it seems unlikely, that is perfectly in keeping with the rest of the Baccarat case. An entertaining experiment, which I've made myself, is to insert a cover over the introduction of Mr. Shaw's book, and over the last page which carries the verdict, and invite someone who knows nothing of the case to read the trial and pronounce Sir William Gordon Cumming guilty or not. Reactions are interesting. Flashman and the Tiger, 1879 and 1894. Chapter 1.
You think twice about committing murder when you're over 70. Mind you, it's not something I've ever undertaken lightly. For all that, I must have sent several score of the Queen's enemies to their last accounts in my time, to say nothing of various bad men and odds bodies who had the misfortune to cross me when my trigger finger was jumpy. More than 100, easy, I should think, which ain't a bad tally for a true blue coward who'd sooner shirk a fight than eat his dinner, and has run from more battlefields than he can count. I've been lucky, I suppose, and devilish quick. But those were killings in the way of business, as a soldier, or in my many misadventures in the world's wild places, where it was me or t'other fella. Murder's different, you see. It takes more courage than I've ever had, to think it out and weigh the consequences, and keep your hand steady as you thumb back the hammer and draw a bead on the unsuspecting back. You need to be in a perfect fever of fear and rage, as I was when I threw de Goethe over the cliff in Germany in 48, or when I sicked on that poor lunatic steward to shoot John Charity Spring, M.A., on the slave ship off the Cuba coast. That's always been more my style, to get some idiot to do the dirty work for me. But there comes a time when there's no scapegoat handy and you have to do the business yourself. And that's when you sweat at the thought of the black cap and the noose at the end of the 8 o'clock walk. Makes my teeth chatter on the glass just to write about it. Aye, and suppose you bungle it and your victim turns on you full of spite and indignation. That can easily happen, you know, when you're an old man with a shaky wrist and a cloudy eye, too stiff in the joints even to cut and run. What business have you got at your time of life to be trying to slaughter a man 15 years younger than you are, in the middle of civilized London, especially when he's a high-tailed gun slick with a belt full of scalps, who can shoot your ears off with his eyes shut? For that's what Tiger Jack Moran was, and no mistake. So, you understand why I say it takes a deal of thought before you determine to go after a man like that with fatal intent, knowing that your speed and cunning have been undermined by a lifetime of booze and evil living, and your white hairs coming out in handfuls. Damn it, I wouldn't have tackled him in my prime when I had size and strength and viciousness to set in the balance against my yellow belly. But there I was, a hoary old grandfather, full of years and dignity and undeserved military honours, with my knighthood and V.C., as respectable an old buffer as ever shuffled down St. James's with a flower in my buttonhole, pausing only to belch claret or exchange grave salutes with cabinet ministers and clubmen. "Why, there's old General Flashman," they'd say. "Dear old Sir Harry, wonderful how he keeps going. They say it's the brandy that does it. Grand old chap he is." That was all they knew. But there I was, I say, at a time when I ought to have had nothing to do but drink my way gently towards an honoured grave, spend my wife's fortune, gorge at the best places, leer at the young women, and generally enjoy a dissolute old age. And suddenly I had to kill Tiger Jack, nothing else for it. What brought the beads out on my withered brow more than anything else is my recollection of our first meeting so many years before, when I'd seen for myself what an ice-cold killing villain he was, Aye, and it was in a place where sheer cool nerve and skill with a gun were the narrow margin between escape and horrible death. You'll remember the name. It's Anluana. I can see it still, the great jagged rock of the little house, rearing up above the stony, sun-baked African plain. The scattered lines of our red-coated infantry, joking and catcalling among themselves, as they waited for the ammunition that never came. The red-capped Natal Kaffirs scurrying back to take their positions on the rocky slope. A black-tunicked rider of frontier horse leaping the gun limbers, bellowing a fatuous order to lager the wagons, which went unheeded and was too late by hours. Pullain, fumbling with his field glasses and shouting hoarsely, "Is that a rider from Lord Chelmsford?" A colour sergeant frantically hammering at the lid of an ammunition box. The puffs of smoke from our advance line firing steadily at the Zulu skirmishers. The rattle of musketry over the ridge to the left. The distant figures of Durnford's men on the right flank, falling back, firing as they came. A voice croaking, "Oh, dear God Almighty!" And it was mine, as I looked northeast over the ranks of the 24th and saw the skyline begin to move, like a brown blanket stirred by something beneath it. And then, all along the crest, there was the rippling, twinkling flash of thousands of spear points and a limitless line of white and coloured shields, with nodding plumes behind them, rank after rank. And down the forward slope came the black spilling tide of Quechua's impis. 20,000 savages rolling towards our pitiful position with its far-stretched line of defenders, death sweeping towards us at that fearful, thunderous jog-trot that made the earth tremble beneath our very feet, while the spears crashed on the oxhide shields, and the dust rolled up in a bank before them, as they chanted out their terrible bass chorus, "Uzitulele, Kagali Muntu," which you'll be enchanted to know means roughly, "He is silent, he doesn't start the attack," which was a bloody lie from where I was standing petrified, and the horrible thing was I wasn't even in the army, but was there by pure chance. How exactly, I'll tell you another time. Much consolation that was, you can imagine, as that frightful black horde came surging across the plain towards our makeshift camp beneath Isanluana Rock, the great mass in the centre coming on in perfect formation, while the flank regiments raced out in the horns which would encircle our position. And there was poor old Flashy, caught behind the companies of the 24th as they poured their volley firing into the chest of the Zulu army, cheering and shouting for the ammunition carriers, and Durnford's bald forehead glinting in the sun above his splendid whiskers as he pulled his men back to the donga and blazed away at the left horn, sweeping in towards them. For one brief moment, as I cast a frantic eye behind me to pick out the quickest line of retreat to the Rorke's Drift track, I absolutely thought it might be a touch and go. You see, while we were most damnably trapped, without proper defences, in spite of the warnings old Paul Kruger had given to Chelmsford about lagering and trenching every night in Zulu country, and while we were only a few hundred white soldiers and loyal niggers against the whole Zulu army, well, a few dozen Martini Henrys, in the hands of men who know how to use them, can stop a whole lot of blacks with clubs and spears. I'd been with Campbell's Highlanders at Balaclava, when they broke the rusky cavalry with two volleys, and I still bore the scars of Little Bighorn, where Reno's troopers held off half the Sioux nation. The other half were killing Custer and me just down the valley, but that's another story. See Flashman and the Redskins. Anyway, as I watched the 24th companies on the Isanluana slope, pouring their fire into the brown, and the artillery banging away for dear life, cutting great lanes in the impis, I thought, "Begod, we'll hold 'em yet." And we would have done, but the ammunition boxes hadn't been broken out, and just as the great mass of Zulus, a bare furlong from our forward troops, seemed to be wavering and hanging back, why, the 24th were down to their last packets, and the yelling and cheering turned to desperate cries of, "Ammunition there! Bring the boxes, for God's sake!" Our fire slackened. The 24th took a step back, the Natal Kaffirs came pouring away from the left under the lee of the hill, flinging their arms aside as they ran, the order, fixed bayonets rang out from the ranks immediately to my front, and the Zulu regiments rallied and came bounding in a great mad charge, the rain of throwing spears whistling ahead of them like hail, and the stabbing assegais coming out from behind the white shields as they tore into our disordered front line, the roar of Soto, Soto, giving way to their hideous hissing, Sji, Sji, as the spears struck home. Time for the lunch interval, thinks I. Let's be off. Once they were at close quarters, there wasn't a hope, and by the look of it, through that hell of smoke and gunfire and fleeing men, with Kaffirs rushing past, and the gunners and wagon men frantically trying to inspan and flee, the surviving remnants of the 24th weren't going to hold that huge press of Zulus more than a matter of minutes. Thus, far in the battle, being only a well-meaning civilian, I'd made a tremendous show of trying to get the wagons to lager in a circle, so that we could make a stand if our forward troops gave way. It was the sensible thing to do, and it also kept me at a safe distance from the fighting. So I was well placed beside an inspanned cart when the dam burst, and the Nokenke regiment of Ketshwayo's army, that's who the historians tell me it was anyway, I only know they were appalling bastards with leopard-skin headdresses screaming fit to chill your blood, came tearing up the hill. I was into that wagon in a twinkling, bawling to the driver to go like blazes, and blasting away over the tailboard with an Adams six-shooter in each fist. I wish I'd a pound for every time I've looked out at a charging barbarian horde with my guts dissolving and prayers babbling out of me, but that one took the biscuit. They came racing in, huge, black-limbed monsters with their six-foot shields up, eyes and teeth glaring over the top like spectres, the plumes tossing, and those disgusting two-foot steel blades glittering and smoking with blood. I saw three men of the 24th, back-to-back, swinging their clubbed rifles, go down before the charge, and the Zulus barely broke stride as they ripped the corpses up with their assegais. To let the dead spirits out, don't you know, and rushed on. I blazed away, weeping and swearing, thinking, oh God, this is the end, I'm sorry I've led such a misspent life, and don't send me to hell, whatever Dr. Arnold says. And my hammer clicked down on an empty chamber just as the first Zulu vaulted over the side of the wagon, howling like a dervish. I screamed and closed with him, seizing his right wrist as the spear point swung at my breast, my hand slipping on that oily skin. I drove a knee at his groin, butting him for all I was worth and trying to bite his throat. All I got was a mouthful of monkey skin collar, and God, how he stank! A shot crashed right beside my ear, and the Zulu fell away, his face a mask of blood. I never even saw who shot him, nor did I pause to inquire, for as I reeled away to the side of the wagon, here came a gun team thundering past, with an artilleryman crouched on one of the leaders, lashing at the beasts and at the Zulus who raced alongside trying to spear him from the saddle. Behind the team, the gun was bouncing over the ground, with some poor devil clinging to the muzzle, his feet trailing in the dust, until a Zulu, leaping behind, dashed his brains out with a knob kerry. You don't think twice at such moments, you truly don't. I had one glimpse that still stays in my memory, of that rock-strewn slope, covered with charging Zulus, spearing the last knots of defenders, of men screaming and falling, of a sergeant of the 24th rolling on the ground, locked with a black warrior, while the others paused to watch, of a bullock lumbering past, bellowing, with an assegai in its flank, of bloody corpses, red-coated or black-skinned, sprawled among the dusty ruin of broken carts, ration boxes and fallen equipment, of hate-filled black faces and polished black bodies. All that in a split second, then I went over the side of the cart in a flying dive onto the gun that was racketing past, clutching frantically at the hot metal, almost slipping down between barrel and wheel, but somehow managing to stay aboard as it tore onwards, bouncing left and right towards the little saddle of ground that runs from Isan Luana Hill. How I survived the next minute, I don't know. I clung to the gun, keeping low, hearing a spear glance clanging from the metal. A club caught me a blow on the shoulder, but I stuck like a leech,
and the gun must have picked up speed, because the closest Zulus were suddenly lost in the dust cloud. And for a moment we were clear of the immediate pursuit. The driver is still holding his seat on the leader, and yelling and quirting away. As the team topped the crest and went careering down the far slope towards the Rorke's Drift track. The slope was thick with fugitives, white and black, a few mounted but most on foot, going pell-mell down to the broken ground and distant scrub, with only one thought in mind, to get away from the merciless black vengeance behind us. They seemed to be making for a deep ravine about half a mile to the left, where it seemed to me they were sure to be caught by the left horn of the Zulu army as it came circling in. I struggled up astride the gun, and bawled above the din to the driver to bear right for the Rorke's Drift road. He cast a terrified glance over his shoulder, pointing frantically and shaking his head. I looked, and my heart died. Already, round the far side of the Isandlwana hill, the vanguard of the Zulu right horn was streaming down like a black lance head to cut the track. I could make out the green monkey caps and plumes of the Tulwana regiment. 5 minutes at most, and the ring of steel would have closed round Isandlwana, and God help anything white that was still inside. There was nothing for it but the ravine, and we rushed down the slope at breakneck speed, the driver lashing the exhausted horses and Flashy going up and down astride that damn barrel like a pea on a drum. I stole a glance back, and beyond the scattered groups of running fugitives, I could see the first ranks of the Zulu chest coming over the hill. This won't do, my lad, thinks I. We'll have to move a deal faster if we want to see Piccadilly again. The gun lurched under me, sickeningly. There was a yell of alarm from the driver ahead, and by God, the right rear wheeler had broken her trace and was veering madly off to the right, head up and snorting. She stumbled and went down as the second trace parted. And I shot off the gun as it slewed round, hit the ground with a fearful jar, and went rolling arse over elbow, tearing the skin off shoulder and knee on the rock-hard earth, for I fetched up winded within a yard of the fallen horse. I had a hand on its mane as it thrashed up again, hooves flying. And you may be sure I wasn't the only one. Half a dozen fugitives had the same notion, and one, a sergeant gunner, was half aboard the beast. "Mind, damn you!" roars he. "She can't take two." "Right you are, my son," says I, and knocked him flying. I got a limb across that heaving bare back, and that's all I ever need. Thank God I've never seen the mount I couldn't master. I wound my hands into the mane, dug in my heels, and went head down for the ravine, just as the gun I'd lately left went careering into it, team, driver, and all. It was a deep, narrow cleft. Christ, was it narrow enough to jump? I tensed myself for the leap, gave her my heel at the last moment, and we went soaring over. There was a horrible instant when we seemed to hang on the far lip, but we scrambled to safety by our eyebrows. I heard a scream behind me, and turned to see a big grey failing to make the same jump. She fell back into the ravine, with her rider crushed beneath her. The ravine and the bank I just left looked like Dante's Inferno. They were fleeing down it among the rock and thorn, towards the Buffalo River 5 miles away, and those black devils were on the far lip. "Ashtee! Ashtee!" and the assegais flashing up and down like pistons. I looked to my right front, where the Tulwana was streaking across the track. There was still a gap between them and the ravine, and I went for it, hell for leather, the horse slithering on the loose rocks, and me clinging like grim death. She was only an artillery screw, but there must have been a hunter ancestor in her somewhere, for she outraced that Zulu pincer with 100 yards to spare, and I was able to hold her in as we shot into the safety of the scrub, with the screams and gunshots fading into the distance behind us. That was how I made my strategic retreat, then, from the massacre of Isandlwana, the greatest debacle of British arms since the Kabul retreat nearly 40 years earlier. Oh, aye, I'd been in that too, freezing and bleeding on that nightmare march which never reached the Khyber. But I'd been a thoughtless boy then. At Isandlwana I was an older, much wiser soldier, and I knew I was a long way from safety yet. I couldn't tell how many others had won clear, about 50 in fact, against 1,000 who fell under the assegais.
but I could guess that the next stop along the line for Cetewayo's merry men would be Rourke's Drift, 8 miles away on the Buffalo. They'd gobble up the pickets there and be over the Natal border by sundown. It behoved Flashy to bear away north and try to cross the river well beyond the reach of the Impis. The trouble was, even I didn't know how fast Zulus can travel with the blood smell in their nostrils. It was about the middle of the afternoon when I came out of the scrub and boulders into a little kraal, perhaps 10 miles from Isan Luana. I reckoned I was clear of pursuit. But my beast was tuckered out, and I could have jumped for joy at the sight of an army wagon among the huts, and a burly red-cheeked sergeant puffing his cutty, while he watched the native women tending a cooking pot close by. It was a stray ammunition cart belonging to a flying column sent out north the previous day. They'd had a brush with some Zulu scouts last evening, and there were two or three wounded on blankets laid across the ammunition boxes. The cart was taking them down to Rourke's Drift, the sergeant said. Not today you ain't, says I, and told him briefly what had happened to most of Chelmsford's force. He goggled and dropped his pipe. Cripes, says he. Why, the rest of our column was making for San Juan this morning. Here, Tiger Jack's got to hear about this. Major, Major, sir, come quick. And that was when I got my first sight of Tiger Jack Moran. He came out of one of the huts in answer to the sergeant's cry. And as soon as I clapped eyes on him, thinks I, this is a killing gentleman. He was perhaps 40, as big as I was, but leaner, and he walked with a smooth, pigeon-toed stride like a great slim cat. His face was lean, too, a nut brown, with a huge hooked nose, a bristling black moustache, and two brilliant blue eyes that were never still. They slid over you and away, and back again. It was a strong face, but mean. Even the rat-trap mouth had an odd lift at one side, which, with the ever-shifting eyes, made it look as though he knew some secret joke about you. For the rest, he wore a faded sapper jacket and a wide-awake hat, with a black sash round his hips. When he turned, I saw he had one of the new, long-barreled Remington 44 revolvers, reversed through the sash over his right rump. A gunfighter's gun with the foresight filed away, if you please. Well, well, thinks I, here's one to keep an eye on. Chelmsford wiped out, you say? The blue eyes looked everywhere but into mine. I wouldn't have trusted this fellow with the mess funds in a hurry. The whole command? Half of it, anyway, says I, guzzling away at a plate of salt and mealies the sergeant had given me. Chelmsford himself's off in the blue with number 3 column. And if he's wise, he'll stay there. Cetewayo's army must be cayudling around Rourke's Drift by now. Thousands of the brutes. There's no hope that way. If it comes to that, I doubt there'll be anything white and living between Blood River and the Tugela by sunrise tomorrow. You don't say, says he. And you got away, eh? You're not army, though. Not at the moment I'm retired, but I imagine you've heard of me. I didn't like his manner above half, with his slippery eyes and half-smile. My name's... Silence! He threw up a hand, and his head jerked round, listening. The sergeant and I held our breath, listening with him. I couldn't hear a thing, beyond the noises of the kraal, the fire crackling, the soft shuffling of one of the nigger women, a baby crying in one of the huts. Just hot silence in that baking sun. And then Moran says sharply to me, "You came on that horse? How long did it take you?" 2 hours, perhaps. Look here, inspan that wagon, he barked to the sergeant. Look alive now, get that damn black driver, sharp's the word. We'll have him on top of us before we know it. Before I could protest, he'd swung away and was running between the huts, jumping onto a great boulder and looking back the way I'd come, shading his eyes. You don't waste time arguing with a man who knows his business. I felt the hot prickle of fear down my spine as I helped the sergeant get the beasts inspanned. They were horses, thank God. Bullocks would have been useless if we were going to have to cut out as fast as Moran seemed to think we must. He jumped down from the rock and came striding back towards us, his head turning left and right to scan the ridges either side of the village, his hand twitching nervously at his right hip. Get those 3 wounded lying down and get aboard yourselves. Driver, start that rig moving. He glanced at me, that sly grin turning the corner of his mouth. I'd climb in, mister, if I were you.
unless my shikari's instinct is playing me false, your black friends are closer than you think. And I don't. Then it happened. And if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I'd not have believed it. And I knew Hickok in his prime, remember, before his eyesight went. And John Wesley Hardin, too. The sergeant, in the act of climbing over the tailboard, let out a hell of a shriek. I glimpsed his face, red and staring, and his arm flung out to point, and then his eyes stared horribly, and he slumped down into the dust, with a throwing assegai between his shoulders, his limbs thrashing wildly. I turned, and there, not 20 yards away, beyond Moran, standing on the boulder he'd just left and poised in the act of throwing, was a Zulu warrior. I can still tell you every detail of him. That's what shock does to you. The great black body behind the red and white shield, the calfskin girdle, the white cowtail garters, the ringed head with its nodding blue plume, even the little horn snuffbox swinging from his neck. It was a nightmare figure, and now there were two more, either side of him, leaping between the huts, screaming, "Stee!" with their assegais raised to hurl at us. Moran had spun on his heel at the sergeant's scream, and I swear I never saw his right hand move, but the Remington was in his fist, and the boom, boom, boom of its triple explosion was almost like one echoing shot. The Zulu on the rock jerked upright, snatching at his face, and toppled backwards. The foremost of the two running towards us pitched headlong, with half his head blown away in a sudden bloody spray, and the third man stumbled crazily, dropping his shield and rolling over and over, to finish a bare 2 yards from us sprawled on his back. There was a hole where his right eye had been, and Moran's pistol was back in his sash. "Twins, by the look of 'em," says he. "Did you know the Zulus think they make the best scouts? Well, don't stand corpin', old fellow. There'll be plenty of live ones on the scene presently. Mind the step." And he was over the back of the moving wagon with me tumbling breathlessly after him, shocked out of my wits by the speed and terror of it all. I'd say from the moment the sergeant fell to our jumping into the wagon had been a good 5 seconds. And in that time, 3 men had died, thank God, and the man beside me was chuckling and pushing fresh shells into his revolver. He was right about the live ones arriving, too, as our wagon wheeled out of the village onto a great empty stretch of plain beyond it. We could see black figures gliding in among the huts on the far side, and by the time we were a furlong out on the plain itself, with the driver lashing like fury and the wagon rolling dangerously from side to side, they were breaking cover in pursuit. There must have been more than 20 of them, and I don't recall a more fearful sight than that silent half-moon of racing black figures, each with his mottled red and white shield and fistful of glittering spears, their white hide kilts and garters flying as they ran. "Ud loco, unless I'm mistook," says Moran. "Good regiment, that. Let's add to their battle honours. What?" He had got a martini from one of the wounded men who were lying pale and silent behind us in the jolting wagon. And now he snuggled the butt into his shoulder, keeping the barrel clear of the rattling tailboard, and let off 4 shots as fast as he could eject and reload. He hit 3 more Zulus, this at a range of 200 yards, from a wagon that was bucking like a ship at sea and at moving targets. I tell you, I was stricken between terror and sheer admiration. "Damnation," says he, after his missed shot. "Bet he felt the wind of it, though." He saw me staring and grinned. "Don't be alarmed, old boy. Just pass up the cartridge packets and I'll have our gallant foes discouraged in half a jiffy. Just see if I don't." But when I applied to the wounded for more cartridges, damned if there was a round among them. "Well, we're sitting on half a ton of the things," says Moran, cool as you please, and tapped the ammunition boxes. "Let's forage, shall we?" So we broke open the case, and it was carbine ammunition, quite unsuitable for martinis. I swallowed my innards for about the 20th time that day. All the boxes carried the same stamp. And there, still loping across the sun-scorched plain behind us, not apparently having lost any distance, were the 20 Zulus, looking as fit as fleas, and a damn sight more unpleasant. "Now that's vexing," says Moran, laying down his rifle and unlimbering his Remington again. He spun the chamber. 6 shots. Well, let's hope none of the horses breaks a leg. What? For God's sake, man," my voice came out in a dreadful squeak, "they can't keep up this pace forever."
Oh, the horses, or Ketchwayo's Sporting and Athletic Club. He gripped the tailboard and weighed the distance between us and our pursuers. I think on the whole I'd put my money on the blacks. More staying power, don't you know? By George, can't they run, though? But my God, we're done for. They're gaining on us, I tell you. Quite, says he. Better think of something, eh? Unless we want our hides stretched over some damned Udloko war drum, that is. Let's see now. He stood up in a swaying wagon, clutching a support, and peered ahead under the canvas cover, resting a hand on the shoulder of the terrified nigger driver who was rolling his eyes and letting his team rip for all it was worth. If I remember right, this blasted plane ends in a deep gully about a mile ahead. There's a crazy kind of bridge over it. We came across it on the way up. It took the wagon all right, but very slowly. Afraid by the time we get across, our friends will be calling on us, and six shots won't go far among that crowd, even if I make everyone tell, which I would, of course. Wait, though. And he dropped down on one knee, pushing one of the wounded men aside, and ferreted among the ammunition boxes. I was hardly listening to him. My eyes were fixed on that line of steadily running black figures, coming on inexorably in our wake. They were losing distance, though, it seemed to me. Yes, there must be nearly a quarter of a mile between us now. But our beasts were tiring, too. They couldn't keep up this speed much longer, dragging a heavy wagon behind them. When we reached the bridge, would there be time for the wagon to make its careful way across before they caught up? I scrabbled at Moran's arm, yammering hopefully, and he grinned as he straightened up from his search among the boxes, holding up a large packet of waxed brown paper in one hand. "There we are, sonny boy," says he, chuckling. "Thought I remembered it. Blasting powder and a darling little primer. Now, watch your Uncle Jack." I don't want to live through another 5 minutes like those last agonizing moments, while we sped across the plain, slower and slower with every yard, straining our eyes back at those distant black figures behind. Even when we reached the gully, a great rocky cleft that stretched as far as one could see on either side, like a volcanic crack, with a rickety plank bridge spanning its 30 feet. There was the time-consuming labour of getting the wounded out and across. The nigger driver and I managed it between us, and sinful hard it was, for two of them had to be carried the whole way. Moran, meanwhile, coaxed the team onto the swaying bridge until the wagon was fairly in the middle of it. Then we outspanned the horses and led them across, glancing back fearfully. There they came, those black fiends of the pit, a bare 100 yards away, sprinting full lick, now that they saw we were halted and apparently stuck. They set up a great yell of "Sutho!" as they tore in towards the bridge, and Moran, who'd been working in the wagon, jumped down and ran across to the little cluster of boulders where we'd laid the wounded. He dropped down beside me, looking back at the wagon. It was perhaps 30 yards off, with the waxed brown packet of gunpowder sitting on top of the ammunition boxes, and the tiny white primer fixed to the side of the packet. With a rifle, I might have hit it myself. All he had was a handgun. "Well, here's luck," says he. "One shot'll have to do it." He was right, I realized, and my mouth was parched with fear. If he missed the primer, his shot would hit the powder packet, but that wouldn't explode it. It would just knock it over, and the primer would go God knew where, and the first Zulu was racing on to the bridge, shield aloft in triumph, with his hideous legion shrieking at his heels. "Gather round, dear boys," murmurs Moran, cocking his pistol. "Get yourselves nice and comfy round the bonfire. Christ!" His head jerked up, the colour draining from his face. It may have been a puff of wind, or perhaps the Zulus swarming past the wagon on that shaky bridge had disturbed it. But the front flap of the canvas cover suddenly swung across, momentarily hiding the tiny white target. It flapped again. For a split second the primer was visible. The first half-dozen Zulus were past the wagon, and within 3 strides of the solid ground, assegai eyes gleaming and knob kerries brandished, howling black faces, another flap of the canvas, the crash of Moran's revolver, and with a roar of thunder, the wagon, the bridge, and everything on it dissolved in a great blast of orange flame. I was hurled flat, my ears deafened and singing. A piece of timber clattered against the rock beside me. I came dizzily to my feet to stare at the empty ravine, with a great black cloud billowing in the air above it, a few shreds of rope and timber dangling from the far lip, and on this side, lying in the dust, a single assegai. Moran reversed his revolver in his hand and pushed it into the back of his sash. Then he tilted his hat back and flicked his forefinger at its brim. "Bayete, old loco," says he softly. "I do like a snapshot, though. Give the gentleman a coconut." That was in 79, my first acquaintance with Tiger Jack, and it was to last only a few more feverish hours, which I'll describe at length some other day, for they don't matter to the tiger's tail, which is strange enough without Rourke's drift to interrupt it. That was a nightmare in its own right, if you like, worse than Little Hand or Greasy Grass, for at least at those I'd been able to run. Why, at the drift, there wasn't even room to hide, and it'll make a ghastly chapter of its own in my African Odyssey, if I can set it down before drink and senility carry me off. Enough for the moment to say that Moran and I were driven, absolutely, into that beastly carnage. You see, with our wagon blown to pieces, he and I lit out on two of the draft screws, leaving the wounded in a dry cave. Moran, intent on fetching help for them, Flashy merely fleeing in his wake, and as dark fell we blundered slap into an impi, for the hills were full of the brutes by now. Then it was head down and heels in, nip and tuck for our lives through the Zulu-infested night, with the fiends howling at our heels, and suddenly Moran was yelling and making for a burning building dead ahead, with all hell breaking loose around it, Zulus by the hundred and shots blazing, and there was nothing for it but to follow, as he went careering through scrub and bushes, putting his beast to a stone wall, and then a barricade where black bodies and red coats were hacking and slashing in the fire glare, bayonet against assegai, and my screw took the wall, but balked at the barricade, which I cleared in a frantic dive, launching myself from a pile of Zulu corpses, landing head first on the smoking veranda of what had been the post hospital, going clean through the charred floor, and being hauled half-conscious from the smouldering wreckage by a huge cove with a red beard, who left off pistoling to ask me where the deuce I'd come from.
This book is continued on Disc 11.